Texas-born poet Joaquin Zihuatanejo often depicts the barrio of East Dallas, where he was raised. He discovered poetry as a young child through his abuelo, who brought home discarded books from wealthy suburbs where he worked as a landscaper, insisting that his grandson read them to him. But it was a student who pushed him to take his poetry seriously, leading to multiple slam poetry championships. His sixth publication, the 2018 book Arsonist, resulted from winning the Anhinga Robert Dana Poetry Prize. It reveals a father he never knew until a Facebook message opened a portal into an unknown world.
That was sort of the beginning of a journey that I was going to take, that were poems that are love letters to my father. The entire book is for him.
Listen to poems that explore family stories and cultural archetypes from the book Arsonist in this 2018 reading at the Kansas City Public Library. This is New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and here's the poet Joaquin Zihuatanejo to tell how he moved from teaching high school to sharing poetry on the stage and the page.
I competed in poetry slams because a student named Marco Zavala challenged me to go out, and he's like, man, go find an audience. You're sharing all your poems with us. I know you want to go be a poet in front of an audience. Go be a poet. I didn't know that you could do that. I thought the poems were for the page. And so it was he who challenged me to go out and find an audience. And I Googled, how do I read poems in front of an audience in Dallas? I literally like typed all that in. And the first thing that popped up was the Dallas Poetry Slam. And it was like this battle. And it was just unbelievably cool. And I was unbelievably not cool. And I just fell in love with the idea of competitive poetry slam where the audience judges you and randomly holds up Olympic scorecards to judge that poem about your deceased grandfather. It was a 6.2. And it sounds harsh and horrible, and it is harsh and horrible, but it's also wonderful and exciting and thrilling. And my first year in poetry slam, I was lucky enough to earn enough points through the season to compete in the city championship for Dallas and had to battle 16 poets in one night. And I was lucky enough to win and be named city champion for Dallas. Because of that, they asked me to represent Dallas at the Texas State Championship in Bryan, College Station, Texas, where I had to battle 20 poets from all over the state of Texas. And I won that too when I was named state champion. I found out about the Arkansas Grand Slam Poetry State Championship. So I drove up there because it was 4 hours away. I'm not from Arkansas, but I entered anyway. And I won 4 years in a row. There's this thing called the Southwest Poetry Slam Championship. It happens every year in the same city in Albuquerque, and poets from California, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and Texas are invited to compete for this Southwest Championship. I'm the only poet to win that twice, back to back. I was asked to represent Dallas the next year at a thing called the Individual World Poetry Slam Championship, where I had to battle 72 poets from all over planet Earth over the course of 4 days, and I was lucky enough to win that too, and because of that, they asked me to represent the entire United States of America at the European World Cup of Poetry Slam that happens in Paris every year. And 16 national champions descend on Paris, and you have to speak in your host language. So the poet from Zimbabwe was speaking in his host language, and I was speaking in English with a little Spanish también thrown in, you know? And the poems are scrolled behind you on a giant screen in French so that the audience can judge your work. But at the end of that week, I was lucky enough to represent the U.S. there. Only one poet on planet Earth has ever won the Individual World Poetry Slam held in North America and the European World Cup of Poetry Slam held in Paris, France. And I'm very humbled and lucky and ridiculous to be that poet for you all. So this is the poem that won the World Cup for us in Paris. Going into the final round on the final day of competition, I was actually in third place. A perfect score is a 30. And mathematically, I needed either a 29.9 or a 30 to win the World Cup going into the final round. And this is the poem that I did. I wrote this for a student named John. It's called Poem for John. So the assignment I gave my high school English students was to write a series of four short haiku poems that distinctly say something about themselves and then recite them to the class. These are the four poems that John recited that day. Speaking in a quiet, communicative way always came easy to me. Accident is equal to invention, but there's hope. I still practice accidents. I restore antique radios. I like the way static feels in my palms. You cannot deny the lucid fact that silence must succumb to voice. And I have to let you know now, John. Although you never uttered one word in class, you spoke volumes to me. And you taught me a lesson in humility. Because I realized that day in my blind and deaf arrogance that I asked you to master my language without attempting to learn one word of yours. So starting today, I'll begin by learning the signs for what I feel the most beautiful spoken words in existence. Words like moon, eclipse, grandfather, sunflower. And I realize now, John, if I were ever to write you a poem, it would probably sound something like this to you. Mother was the moon, and father was the sun. The moon and sun that existed in a constant state of eclipse, so I learned to grow despite the darkness. And I learned at an early age the power of spoken word. My mother's silence and my father's absence formed cave walls that my grandfather's words reverberated off of, like children dancing in a field of purple simply for the sake of purple. And it is true. Metaphorically speaking, I'm that sunflower growing wildly in the alley adjacent to nothing. And though my petals extend upwards toward darkness, my roots extend deeply toward the warmth of all the voices that nourish me or didn't nourish me. So thank you, mute mother. Thank you, absent father. Thank you, beautiful, all-encompassing grandfather. And thank you, John, my silent, poetic student, for your words.
Poem for John by Joaquin Zihuatanejo. As good as it is to hear this poem, seeing it makes you understand why he won the 2009 World Cup Poetry Slam, since he incorporates sign language into his performance, making it as magical as dance. You can find a YouTube link to see him on our website, newletters.org. Now here's the poet to talk about what led him to write his 2018 book, Arsonist.
I graduated with my MFA last year. And for the MFA process, part of the thesis is a creative manuscript. This book is the culmination of that 2 years. I was halfway through my MFA, halfway through with a new creative project that was going to be a book that had no title. And one of my astonishing professors, a poet named Sherwin Bitsui, who told us in the MFA program that we have to tack the manuscript on the wall as we're working on the new book, and then put revisions of that poem on top of it, so that you can go back and look at the earlier revision of the poem. You can see the poem grow in depth and the book grow in length and depth as well on your wall. And I was halfway through my MFA program, and I had about 40 pages of my manuscript. I was about halfway through my manuscript on my wall. And I liked a lot of the poems very much, and I wasn't crazy about a lot of the poems very much. I thought it had a little bit of promise, but it was still, you know, a work in progress for sure. And then my next-door neighbor, who's a retired dentist, said, "Hey, Joaquin, how about you go to Aspen for a week for free? I got a timeshare that's expiring. It's like a 6-star timeshare." And so my wife and I are in Aspen, and we're both laying in bed, and we're kind of leaning back on the headboard, and there's a fire, and it's beautiful. And she has her laptop in front of her, and I have my laptop in front of me. But my wife turned to me, and she said, "I just got a notification I've never got before on Facebook. Tell me what it means." She showed me her screen. I said, "Oh, that's a message request." She goes, "What's that?" I said, "That's when someone is not your Facebook friend. They're asking you for permission just to simply send you a message. You don't even have to open that sucker. You can just hit decline." She goes, "I've never gotten one. I'm going to open it." So she accepted the request. And then her face just contorted. And it changed to an expression that I'd never seen in all of our years of marriage. And she said, "Joaquin, this message isn't for me. It's someone who recognized my last name as yours, and they're trying to get a hold of you. You need to read this now." And I read it, and it was 23 words long. "You don't know me? Not really? And I hate to tell you like this, but my father, I mean our father, has died. And that's how I found out that the man who left my mother and me the year that I was born and never came back had died from a Facebook message request from a stranger who shared half of my blood." We went home the next day. Those 23 words were just resonating in my head. And that night when we got home, I walked into my office where my manuscript was tacked on the wall, and I tore every page down. And I started writing the first poem in this new book. And I called it Nova because all the stories I have of my father were whispered to me by my drunk uncles. And one of them told me one time he drove away from you and your mom in a 1971 Chevy Nova. One of our professors on faculty is the brilliant Orlando White. He's a Native American poet. He writes a lot of one-word poems. He feels free to alter spelling whenever he wants to. He's mystified by words and the power of one word. But if you think about Orlando's theory of one word and the story that lies inside the letters, in the space between the letters, if you make it bigger and bigger and bigger, increasing the white space between each letter, the word nova transforms before your very eyes into two Spanish words, nova, which means don't go or not going. This is nova, snow, the day you are born. Such unusual weather for the desert you inherit. But you refuse to let this story begin with white, so you change it. Rain, the day you are born. Such unusual weather for the desert you inherit. Your father stands outside the emergency room doors, a soft pack of Camel Straights in his hand. His swimming pool eyes, a stark contrast to the gray sky above. No, there will be no white transitions in this story. His sunless eyes, a stark contrast to traceries of Asia above. Your mother screams, pushes you into the world after 17 hours of labor. The nose and mouth are suctioned. You take your first breath, cry. Your father, silent as benzene, exhales white smoke through both nostrils. Stop. You will not allow intangible whiteness to appear in this story. Your father, silent as arsenic, exhales smoke more blue than wan through both nostrils. She places the baby against her flesh. You refuse to latch. Exhausted, your mother rests from the pain of birth, closes her eyes. He places the key in ignition. It cranks, but refuses to start. Flooded, your father leans back on the headrest, closes his eyes. On the radio, Stuart begs Maggie to wake. With a furious rattle and hum, the big block V8 turns over. You cannot recall if the Chevy is pearl or silver. This is all a story whispered to you by an uncle who rises crudo and angry on Sunday mornings. Call the car black. Call the father back. Blue blanket, brown skin. No getting around those hospital walls. Anemic, bloodless, impossibly white.
Nova, the opening poem from the award-winning book Arsonist by Joaquin Zihuatanejo, reading at the Kansas City Public Library and on New Letters on the Air.
So that was sort of the beginning of a journey that I was going to take, that were poems that are love letters to my father. The entire book is for him. Not long after my half-sister reached out to me, my wife reached out to her, knowing that I'm a writer and how much faith I place in the word. And she reached out to her and said, can you send us Joaquin's father's obituary so that he can read it? And she did. And when I read it, I noticed instantly, and after reading it over and over again, I noticed it every time that I read it, that I was not in it. I had been written out of my father's life, even in death. And there's power in the word, you know? So I rewrote it as a poem. This is called The Breath of Our Disconnection, or On Finding Out That I Was Left Out of My Father's Obituary. He is survived by sheets soiled crimson, crumpled cold on hospital floor. Survived by blood in lungs, throat, and mouth, hair in sink, by chemotherapy, by diagnosis. Survived by pain in side and shortness of breath, by calloused hands, farm jack, come along, whirly jig. He is survived by new family and new priorities, by community college art classes, by not so brown boy, by the idea of beautiful brown woman. He is survived by pills of different colors and sizes, by PTSD, by Agent Orange. He is survived by severed limbs and wails of soldiers too young for death, by Ho Chi Minh City, unit, corps, God, and country, Act One of Hamlet, by paint by numbers, survived by amniotic fluid in lungs, throat, and mouth, by unbuckled belt and floral print dress on the floorboard of a Chevy, by young man and younger woman swaying in time in Texas dance hall. He is survived by I'm so lonesome I could cry playing on the jukebox. I love poems that do that, they go backwards in time. The original title of the book was going to be called Causes of Degradation, because that night when I tore every poem down off my wall, I sat at my desk and I wrote a question to myself, and I wrote, how did your father's absence make you feel? And the answer that I wrote underneath was, I wrote one word, degraded. It made me feel degraded. So I typed into my search engine the word degraded, and I didn't kind of really feel what popped up, so I changed it to degradation, and I typed that in. And the first thing that came up was this scientific article on the causes of degradation in land formations in topsoil. And it was broken into 10 parts, and each part had this bold, all-capped word that was that category of land degradation. And I thought to myself, what if I could simply take those 10 words out and relate my father's relationship or the absence of that relationship to those words and see what I could come up with? I had a lot of conversations with my professors about the title being Causes of Degradation, but there was a lot of fire imagery in the book, so I started thinking about the word arsonist because I always felt burned by my father's absence. And then James Alunyota Stevens, who is just one of the most astonishing poets we have today, he was one of my professors as well, and he said to me, are you still thinking about causes of degradation or arsonist as the possible titles? And I said, yes, I am. I'm torn, James. And he said, you should use arsonist. It has the word son in the middle of it, S-O-N. He goes, and it also has the sentence, our son is, inside that one word. And I was like, oh, this book's being called Arsonist, trust me. Like, after that, that's the title. But this was the original poem that was sort of the catalyst for the entire thing, that was the original working title for a long time. So this is a sequence poem. It's a little long, but I hope you find some light in it. This is called Causes of Degradation, a sequence. Air pollution. She left the photos up for a while. You hung over us like sulfur dioxide, visible and invisible. My smile on your face in the Polaroids. I took them down one night as she slept. Hid them from her in a boy's desperate attempt to clear the air. A son will do anything to help his mother breathe easier. Fires. So many nights she pulled the lit unfiltered Camel from between your lips. She told me more than once you almost burned us to the ground as we slept. When you leave something unattended, negligently discard cigarettes, suns, and all such small things, you turn flesh into debris. The ultimate goal of the arsonist is to destroy wholly or in part. Overexploitation. You tried so hard to ruin us with your carelessness. Hands covered in paint above a once blank canvas, an over-abstraction. Just a fancy word for prolonged periods of drought. Logging. You uprooted sapling, piñon, nogalito, chisos, stripped it and left it bare. There was no way to hold the soil in place. Insects. Surely you must know, encroachment of any kind can contribute to the loss of something small and rare. Pests and vegetation diseases. Eventually I poured gasoline on the photos, set them ablaze. Cleansing by fire. I watched our faces blacken in the flame. Any poison meant to kill the predator will eventually destroy the prey. Firewood scavenging. In the darkest part of the forest, moss grows so deep that walking makes no sound. This is how you slipped away into the ink. Shoes in one hand, flint in the other. Silently searching for cattails, fungus, compressed flower tops to catch the spark. When you apply the heat but starve it of breath, the ember becomes highly combustible. Animal foraging. If given the choice, we would rather freeze than starve. Even in winter, we would seek farther. Forage longer than our fathers. We came to know intense shivering and slurred speech in an intimate way. Pasturing and overgrazing. It is uncertain how long the recovery period will last. We should have known something wild and non-native would refuse to take root in such an arid place. Industrialization. There was nothing natural about the rhythm we created. There was never a homeland to be lost. Urbanization, fatherless boys find each other, become brothers, bound to one another by the want of blood. Though shifting variables make predictions about future growth next to impossible, some things were certain, Natural causes included earthquakes, storms, and wild boys setting photos on fire. Economic impact was a child support check that bounced. Overpopulation was three brothers sleeping on a fold-out couch in the living room. Extinction was a cop car parked on the corner of Bonita Boulevard and Mañana Avenue. It was all so close, so far away.
That's the poem Causes of Degradation, one of the working titles of Joaquin Zihuatanejo's sixth book, Arsonist. This is New Letters on the Air.
I used to teach public high school 11th grade English, a bunch of other things too, but that was one of my preps. And we would do a unit on archetypal symbolism, and I got to talk about Jung. It was just amazing. It was so much fun talking about archetypal symbols, which are symbols that have been around so long, we don't even know why they're symbols, they just are. Like, we don't know how it started. And it doesn't matter about time or geography. In other words, you could be like a teenager in Rome 200 years ago, or you could be like an 11-year-old Guatemalan boy today, and whenever you see the word fire in a poem or a short story or a novella, it means the same thing to all of us, every single one of us. It means life. It means energy. We don't know why it means that, but it does. And I would teach them that even numbers can be archetypal symbols, ancient. There's numbers that appear in poetry and stories time and time again. They have archetypal meanings associated with them, like the number three. It's a very powerful archetypal number. It's a very patriarchal, this masculine patriarchal number. And the number four, oh, powerful archetypal number. It's also very matriarchal. So we have the matriarch, and we have the life cycles and the four seasons, and the only thing that can create life is woman. So I would tell my students, why do you think everyone's favorite number is seven? And their minds would go poof. And I got to watch it happen in my classroom every year. It was awesome. So I wrote this poem for three men and for four women. It's called Archetypes. Three. I will tell you three things about my father, and one will be a lie. My father left the year that I was born. My father's heart, like mine and yours, is made up of four chambers, but only three work well. My father's left atrium broke the day he walked away from me. There were three of us. We all came from the same mother, but different fathers. We all have different colored eyes, but the same smile. We're all different, but the same. We're all different, but the same. We're all different, but the same. Four. I think I have only loved four women in my life well. At some point in your life, you should take all the money in your wallet and spend it on the women in your life that you have loved well. At this exact moment, counting the change in my pocket, I currently have just under $7 on me. I would buy the first woman a white peach because she once moaned after biting into one. I would buy the second woman a pack of sugar-free gum because she is diabetic. I would buy the third woman a disposable camera, which seems insignificant, but oh, can you imagine the possibilities in those 24 exposures? The fourth woman, I would give this poem, as I would likely be out of money at this point. This part of the poem says as much about the fourth woman's love of poetry as it does about my ability to budget money well. I'm writing this poem in an airport. There's a very good chance my phone will be dead when we land. When we land, I don't want to call the four women I've loved well. I want to call all the women I did not love well and tell them just how sorry I am. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Sorry. Seven. My favorite movie growing up as a kid was The Magnificent Seven, a remake of the classic Japanese film The Seven Samurai. In terms of film, my favorite childhood movie is An American Bastard, but it's a good one. So am I. So are my brothers. You could teach a class on archetypal symbolism from just that film alone. The star of that film, Yul Brynner, died of lung cancer. Just before he died, he shot one of the most powerful and poignant public service announcements. That PSA ends with Yul Brynner staring into your soul from inside the black and white television, repeating three words, just don't smoke. I swear it must have run seven times a night during the prime time of my youth. And though I can't be certain of it, I think in the end, those may have been Yul Brynner's last words. When I was 7, I learned that my father smoked unfiltered Camels. So did Yul Brynner. And though I can't be certain of it, I think in the end it will not be my father's metaphorical broken heart, nor will it be his actual broken heart that gets the best of him. In the end, it will be his lungs. And I, his firstborn son, will not get to be there to hold his hand when he dies. I will not get to hear his last words. I will not get to ask for or accept his forgiveness. In the end, there will be only silence. I forgive you. 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 I just found out my flight is delayed. It will not land until 7 p.m. Will the women I did not love well forgive me for my silence? For those times I should have been silent but was not? Will they forgive me for my carelessness with words? Or my carelessness with all four chambers of the human heart? Will they forgive me for loving words more than I love them? Will they forgive me for all the poems I've written about them? Or all the poems I haven't written about them? I want to write a collection of 28 poems. 7 poems for each of the 4 women that I have loved well. And though I love them all, I will reserve the use of closed form for only one of them. I will write her 7 Shakespearean sonnets. No. I will write her 7 villanelles. No. I will write her 7 epic poems written in rhyming couplets. No. I will write her 7 powerful and poignant PSAs that will all end the same with 3 words repeating, I love you, 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 I love you. Thank you for listening.
Joaquin Zihuataneo at the Kansas City Public Library reading the poem Archetypes from his book Arsonist, published in 2018 by Florida's Anhinga Press as the winner of the Anhinga Robert Dana Prize for Poetry. For links to his book and the full library presentation, visit newletters.org. To hear our show again, stream it on our website or listen to our free podcast. Here's New Letters editor Robert Stewart on how to keep the show coming your way.
If you find this program about writers valuable and enjoyable, you might like to know that New Letters requests your support in our first capital campaign to endow this radio series and its affiliate, New Letters Magazine. New Letters on the Air for 42 years is the program of Gwendolyn Brooks, Joseph Brodsky, Lee Young Lee, Alice Walker, Grace Paley, and Calvin Trillin. New Letters Magazine for 85 years is the magazine of Etheridge Knight, Richard Wright, John Updike, Annie Dillard, Achebe, Cannell, Kuman, and Ginsberg. Go to newletters.org, send your tax-deductible gift, and let's secure this legacy of publications and broadcasts for future generations.
That Support New Letters button in the top right corner of the website also covers Bookmark Press that has published collections such as Currents by Bojan Lewis, winner of the 2018 American Book Award for Poetry. And We Are Taking Only What We Need, Stephanie Powell Watt's short stories that won the Ernest J. Gaines Award and have since been picked up by a larger publisher, Echo, to pair with her first novel. Any donation helps our mission to discover, publish, broadcast, podcast, and promote great writing. A production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC, today's show was produced with Danny Reeves, Ashley Cote, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.